There we go. Let's remind ourselves what the third commandment is. What's the third commandment? Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Okay? We talked about several things about that, several components of that, that lead us to understand what the essence is. We talked about name. What's a name? We talked about what it means to take the name of the Lord, which is to identify ourselves with God. And taking it in vain. And what's the concern there? I know Dale's going to have an answer. You've been thinking about the third commandment for a week? Yeah, what's... Not talking about Jody's commandment. We're talking about the Ten Commandments. Anybody? Anybody have any thought? So what's the underlying concern of that? Why would that be bad?
If you're identifying, and that's supposed to be the essence of your life, then you're not showing proper respect or proper appreciation for God's position or authority.
Okay. Okay. Leading them astray with respect to what? Now, usually we answer that by saying leading them away from God, but I'm not talking about that. Yeah, it is that, but... What it means to be a Christian, but if being a Christian is identifying ourselves with God, taking His name, then we're leading them astray with respect to what God's like, aren't we? Yeah. In the same way that fathers who are bad fathers distort children's understanding when God is called Father. And He's the one from whom all fathers in heaven and on earth are named. Our understanding of fatherhood comes from who God is, but if fathers are not good fathers, and then they call God Father, what does that do to their understanding of God? And there are a lot of kids who are really messed up and or who are resentful of God for precisely that reason. And so, you know, when I was toying around with this, I thought, okay, well, the essence is theological rectitude, correct theological understanding. But I think that's only that's unto something else. And really, what I think the essence of this is the honor of God. We could say reverence for God. But it's the honor of God that's the principle here. What are we doing when we take God's name in vain? We're dishonoring God, either by distorting who He is, or by not giving Him, by doing something that compromises the reverence or the honor that's due His name. So this is where taking His name in vain, where we're using God's name, and we're not as a swear word, but we're not thinking about God when we do that with adequate reverence. Yeah, that's why that's a part of this. But there's a lot more involved in it than that.
That would extend to using the word, misusing the word too. I mean, I think about a lot of times in conversation, the way we casually apply His word in certain ways or inaccurate ways.
Yes. Yeah, because His word's the revelation of Him fundamentally. Yeah. Yeah. And because when we talk about theology proper is the study of God. Every other area of theology relates to that and flows out of who God is. So, yeah, from where does theology come? Our theology comes from God's Word, God's revelation of Himself. Now, I think it's important before we get to the next command to notice that there's a logical progression here. Okay? And all of these have to do with each other. Okay? They're bound up with each other. But there is a distinctness to each command. And I want to comment on something that Dale just said, that we obey the law. Yeah. But you can get that out of every command. And something that I think Richard Gaffin has a critique of Calvin's view on the Sabbath, which is the next command that we're going to talk about. And one of his main points is that Calvin's view is inadequate because what it does is it absolutizes it sees the essence of a single command as something that's appropriate only to a summary of the whole law. And we can't say that the essence of any specific command, that its distinct essence, is to obey the whole law, because that's the summary of the whole law. And so the whole point of, you know, the summary is love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And what the Ten Commandments, breaking that down into ten, means that we're breaking that down into ten more distinct concerns that are themselves a summary, but they're a more explicit summary. They have to do with that summary as a species has to do with genus. They're a more specific segment of that overall summary. Okay, so we don't want to summarize. We want to see how each one ties into that. To be sure, we need to see that, but we also need to see what's the distinct thing about each one of these, because that's their value. That's the value of summarizing it in ten commandments. Okay, and there's a progression here, because we start by talking about God's absoluteness. And God is the exclusively absolute. Okay? He's the only one that's truly God. So we don't attribute deity or divine characteristics to anything but God or anyone but God. And then that leads to, okay, then as we think about the creation, then there's a distinction between creator and creature, and we need to maintain that distinction. We need to understand what's the difference. And we don't attribute divine characteristics to creatures, but neither do we understand God as entirely like the creation. We understand His transcendence. We understand even though we can't completely comprehend what's involved in that, because we're creatures, we still understand there's a distinction there. And so we don't. And so the way that we worship God has to. All of these have to, you know, have implications for worship. We don't worship God by thinking of Him as summed up in terms of some image in the creation or like the creation. Or we don't worship the creation as God. We don't worship sun, moon, and stars. Or as awesome as we may think the sun is, it's not an object of worship because it's part of the creation. Things like that. And then that helps us to see, okay, what are we actually thinking about then? We're thinking about proper reverence for God, giving God His place, okay? Which is what I think the third commandment is really focusing on, the honor of God, particularly in how we identify with God as His people. And that then leads us, that introduces the concept of image-bearing. Because that's what this is really getting. We identify with God. It's possible for us to identify with God. Why? Because He's created us in His image. Now, we've already got the equipment to understand that properly, because being in God's image doesn't mean that we are God or that we will become God or that we are divine or there's a spark of divine in us, or, you know, the things that you hear in terms of New Age thinking or this great chain of being thinking that we talked about, which is really the alternative to a biblical worldview. It's either everything's one and I'm part of it, and so God is everything and I'm part of that, so I'm divine, or there's a distinction and an absolute distinction, but there's a link. And the honor of God is in part tied up with my reflection of Him. That my purpose, as is the purpose of everything, is to manifest, that means make visible, make detectable, make obvious, make observable the excellencies of God, which we call the glory of God. The glory of God is the manifestation of His character, of who He is, of His excellencies. That's the glory of God. So our purpose is to do this. It is to glorify God. How do we do that? We do that by reflecting Him, because there, and what is that? That's an identification with God. You look in the mirror, your image is identified with you. The image is not you. The image is less real than you are, but it's derived from you. If the mirror is bent or warped, then the image is warped. But and that doesn't reflect you accurately. That's what sin does. And so all of that then leads to what's probably, it may take the rest of our time talking about this, and if Dwayne were here, I know it would take the rest of the time, because this is something that Dwayne loves to talk about. But we come to the fourth commandment. And I think it's really the fourth commandment: remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Now, that's not all of the fourth commandment. And every part's important. But that's the summary that most people, it has to do with the Sabbath day. How do we understand the Sabbath day? What's that about? And there's been a lot of debate about this, a whole lot of debate about it. And what's interesting is if you start to study the Sabbath day, you see that it's bound up with things that are much more fundamental than just taking a nap on Sunday. There's a lot more to it. And it has to do with some of these fundamental concepts. And when we talked about the third commandment, we said name is a fundamental concept. taking the name of God is a fundamental concept. Doing that in vain. What is it? What is vanity? A vain way of doing that. That's a fundamental concept. In the same way, when you come to the fourth commandment, you have some of these fundamental concepts, like rest and labor. And time, 7 and 1, a rhythm. And there are others. So, you know, and this is, it ends up being really complex. But when you start studying the Sabbath, you see that the way the Scriptures talk about the Sabbath, for instance, when the Sabbath is instituted in the Mosaic Law, then that's not the institution of the Sabbath. And here's another fundamental principle when we're talking about this. When was the Sabbath instituted? Yeah, creation. Okay? And that qualifies the way we think about the Mosaic legislation. Because when in the Mosaic command, in the Ten Commandments, it refers back to creation, right? For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested. For this is the basis for what you're supposed to be doing. Now we're already talking about some of how we what's involved in how we understand it. But if you look at throughout the Mosaic Law, the way that God talks about the Sabbath, one of the things that he says, and I'm going to put it this way, and I've already, it's because of the context of this discussion, you're going to get this answer really quickly. But when I ask this, when we're not talking about this, okay, what we're talking about, I sometimes ask this question and people have a really tough time. You go through the Bible and you talk about covenants. Okay, and we talk about the covenant of grace, and our understanding is the covenant of grace is divided into these developmental epochs that are structured in terms of individual covenants. Okay, so we have a covenant in the garden, a covenant of creation that includes the cultural mandate, covenant with Adam, we can say, although you want to distinguish that from covenant of works, okay, which is also big picture with Adam and contrasted with covenant of grace, which is really fundamentally with Christ and Adam and Christ. But there's a covenant in the garden that's part of the covenant of grace, right? Because God gives them a promise of a seed who's going to crush the head of the serpent. And that's told them in the garden, right? Okay, so there's an and then successively through Scripture we have these other developments that and the watershed that divides them is the making of a covenant. So what's the next covenant that we see after the garden in Scripture? It's part of the plan of salvation, plan of redemption. Noahic, okay, covenant. It's not with Noah, it's with all living creatures at the time of Noah. Okay, so we call it the Noahic covenant. All right, what's the next one? Abrahamic covenant. Okay, then what's next? Mosaic. What's next? Davidic with David, and then all culminating in. Somebody said something. The New Covenant. Yeah, right. The New Covenant culminated with Christ, okay, which is the sort of where everything's leading, the covenant of fulfillment. Okay, and that's mentioning them. One key thing when we talk about each one of these covenants, among other things, is that each one has a sign, a distinctive sign, okay? Now, we could debate this. I have my own opinion, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. But What's the sign of the covenant of creation? Or the covenant, the Adamic covenant that's part of the covenant of grace. What's the sign? Well, even though they are driven from the garden, it's still a sign. It's in the garden. It's the tree of life. And really the way that redemption is couched is in terms of a return to the garden and a free partaking of the tree of life, which represents Christ. And how do we know that? Because that's how Revelation portrays salvation and the promise of Christ. To him who overcomes, I will give the right to what? To live in the paradise of God and eat and partake of the tree of life. So, okay, tree of life. What's the sign of the Noahic covenant? Okay. God's bow in the clouds. He says that. And I don't want to make this a lesson on the covenant, so I'm tempted to go into it, but I'm not going to. Okay, what's the sign of, let's skip Mosaic for a second. No, what's the sign of Abrahamic covenant? Circumcision. Yes. What's the sign of the Davidic covenant? Well, yes, kingdom, but it is the king sitting on the throne. It is, and not only a king, but a son of David sitting on the throne. And that's why. And I can't resist giving this reference. One of the indications of this is in the Olivet Discourse, where Jesus is talking about the last days, and he says, "Then the sign of the Son of Man in heaven will appear in the sky." Now, if we interpret that as future to us, we completely misunderstand it. But if we understand it in terms of its context, we understand it has to do with 70 AD. And we also understand the Greek properly. It's not the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, like many translations say. That's an inaccurate translation. It's because in the sky should be in heaven. And in heaven, that prepositional phrase is an adverbial prepositional phrase that tells where the sign. It's an adjectival, not adverbial. It doesn't tell where the sign will appear. It modifies the Son of Man. It modifies Son, the Son in heaven. The sign of the Son of Man in heaven will appear. And that's the word order, actually. And so what it's saying is there's a sign that the Son of Man is in heaven. And what does that mean? That he's ruling. Where is he in heaven? Where is Christ? He's ascended to the throne. And so there is a Son of David on the throne. In fact, the ultimate fulfillment, the ultimate sense of what that means has happened. And Christ says, at this time when all these things are happening, and I think if we understand them properly, we understand them as in reference to 70 AD, the sign that the Son of Man is in heaven, ruling. What's that sign? Well, then it will appear. And what's he taught? What is he talking about throughout that passage? He's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. The destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. And the temple ritual and everything associated with the ceremonial law is a sign. And what's it a sign? It's a sign that Christ is ruling. How? Well, if you ask a Jew who believes that the temple needs to be rebuilt, Orthodox Jews are planning for the temple to be rebuilt. Why? Because they can't obey the law. They can't obey the Old Testament law unless there's a temple. And it has to be in that spot. And there have to be animal sacrifices. There haven't been animal sacrifices in the temple. There haven't been temple rituals that are ordained by God in the Old Testament for how many years? Over 2,000? So, if God allows the temple to destroy, He's given all these commands, but He allows the temple to be destroyed, of what is that a sign? Is what you can ask Jews. If Jesus wasn't the Messiah, how could God allow the temple to be destroyed? If the fulfillment of all these to which these things pointed hasn't come, if Jesus wasn't that, then how could God allow this whole economy to be wiped out and destroyed? It is a sign of that God is ruling, that Christ, that God is ruling through the Son of David who is now on the throne.
And what would they say to that?
You know, I have only asked a couple of Jews that, and they didn't have a good answer. And they were being more honest. I think some, you know, probably a mixture of double talk, but it wouldn't be an adequate answer. There is no answer for that. There is no adequate answer for that. That's why it's such a powerful apologetic tool. But do you see, that's a sign. Christ ruling is a sign that indicates part of the essence of the covenant as kingdom. Okay? And what's the sign of the new covenant? We could say really there are two primary, but there's one that's really associated with explicitly by Christ as a sign. Yeah, the Lord's Supper. This is the covenant, this is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for many for the remission of sins. So, okay, now, we skipped one. What's the sign of the Mosaic Covenant? Mosaic Covenant talks about circumcision, but that goes back to Abraham. And Paul even makes that point. Well, that's what the Mosaic Covenant involves, but that's not the sign. Remember, a sign is something that represents something visible that represents something invisible. Now, do what? That's a sign, but it's not the sign of the Mosaic Covenant. I don't think it's a sign. It is typological. But I don't think that's a sign. There is something that's called a sign. And it's in the Pentateuch, and it's called a sign of the Mosaic Covenant. This is a sign for you. No.
Oh, I was guessing baptism.
Yeah, but this is Mosaic Covenant. Now there were baptisms in the Mosaic Covenant. Well, but think about the context. I said y'all were going to get this right away because of the context of the discussion. What's the context of our discussion? No, we've moved on from the third. The Sabbath. The Sabbath is said to be the sign of the Mosaic Covenant.
We'd have got that.
Yeah. Now think about that for a second. Good. But y'all got it. Y'all got it. You got it. Now think about that. Think about that. Have you ever thought about the Sabbath that way? It's a sign of the Mosaic Covenant. That means you got to think about, okay, what was the Mosaic Covenant? What was its place in the development of the history of redemption? And how is the Sabbath a sign of that? What does it represent? And see, that is the reason I went through all of that, is so that you can see Sabbath, the concept of Sabbath, involves so much more than how we usually think of the Sabbath. And how obviously, if you go through the Gospels, as we've been talking about in our small group lately, because we've been going through Gospels, the way Jesus thought of the Sabbath involved a radically different way of thinking about it than the Pharisees had. Well, of course, they distorted what constantly? The application of the Mosaic Law. And so, if we think of, okay, it's a sign of the Mosaic Covenant, but it was instituted at creation. So it wasn't something that Moses came up with or that God came up with only for Israel at this time. Like so many of, we shouldn't think of it as a ceremonial law that's associated only with Moses, that's done away with Christ. Or that we don't observe anymore because of Christ, because it's not in that category. It has to do with the Mosaic Covenant, but it doesn't receive its validity or its origin from Moses. Its origin is in creation. So it has to do with the way fundamentally we think about ourselves in terms of this stuff, right? The creation, my relationship to the creation, my relationship to God, how I honor God, image bearing, image. Has to do with all of that. And you can, when you begin to see the progression in the Ten Commandments leading up to this fourth commandment, you start to see something about what its essence is. Now we got 11 minutes. We're going to talk about this. I'm going to flesh this out because it, really, in some ways, to talk about the fourth commandment, it's almost more complex than any other commandment, at least in terms of my experience in coming to grips with it. But what I want to do the rest of the time is I just want to throw this out to you, again, because I want you to think, I want you to wrestle with this. I want to just give you the answers. I want, because you'll profit much more if you wrestle with this first. So what's the essence of the fourth commandment? What's the concern there? And you have to think about, all right, what does the command say? What are the concepts that are involved in this? We mentioned some of them earlier. How do you put this together? I think Calvin put it together wrong, and I don't think I'll have time to talk about that today. I think he put this particular thing together wrong. This is one of the areas where I disagree with Calvin, which is very rare. But I think I can show you, and I'm really leaning on. I first heard this from Richard Gaffin, professor of theology at Westminster, who wrote his master's thesis on this. But what's the essence? I'm not expecting y'all to come up with this full-blown answer right now, by the way. Don't think I am. But trusting God. Okay, how so, Scott? Yeah, and I think that's a great insight into the import of the fourth commandment and observing the, that's a great application of it, because and really in some sense, again, I would say you can do that with all of them, because they all involve, they all are an expression of faith. And there's a great insight into how this is, when we observe this commandment, it's an expression of faith. That's one of the ways it is, yeah. Because I got to trust God. I'm not going to pull my hair out thinking I've got to work 7 days instead of six. I can take the time to do what God says I should do in this day. And I trust Him for provision. And that's involved in that. Yeah, so, yeah. I'm not sure I'd say that's the essence of it, but that's certainly involved in it. Yeah.
The two Sabbath cases that we just looked at in Luke and small group was Christ feeding the hungry on the Sabbath and healing the man's withered hand on the Sabbath. And he asked the question to his accusers, is it lawful to do good or evil on the Sabbath? And logically, flowing out of honoring God is to do good, is to do the work of God.
Yeah. Right? Okay, now, yeah, that's certainly a component. Is that the whole concern? Does that sum up the whole thing of the Sabbath? You think? Well, no, this is good. This is what I want you to... This is what I want you to do, because this is what leads you, if you think, okay, yeah, this is part of it, but then if you see, okay, this is part of it too, then you put all those things together, that's what leads you to, okay, what sums up all of these things? So, yeah, I mean, I think both of these are elements, yeah.
I'll just say this, and you can make that face again.
What face? What face? That was that salad I ate late last night.
This isn't very well formulated, so bear with me. But in terms of the Sabbath, keeping the Sabbath holy, and it being about honoring God and focusing on God, and God being the priority, and us being about His business, and Him being relating that to our ultimate Sabbath rest when Christ returns.
Okay.
It seems like what will be the ultimate, I mean, where our image bearing will be perfected.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So what are you, tell me again, I didn't get, what are you saying the essence might be? What are you suggesting?
Well, I'm thinking that Sabbath that we're talking about now is a prototype for the Sabbath to come.
Yeah. It's a sign. It's a sign of something. Yeah. So sign, the sign isn't the reality, but it's a token. It contains a token of the reality. Okay. Gail, you had your hand up.
Well, yeah, I was trembling.
But you rest, Jody, and that's, yeah. You're pointing back to that rest. What's the ultimate rest? Sabbath rest, okay.
I think it would just be summed up with remembering God. And that's what it tells you. It says, therefore, God has commanded you to remember your slave after it's given all the...
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, certainly. Yeah. I think if you think about everything it says, I think again that's one component that's involved in it. I wouldn't say that's the total essence, because there are things in there that doesn't address. Just like, that's the thing. If you think, okay, maybe this is this, and it's because you're noticing this, then you think about all the others, does that address this and this and this? And so that's how you can tell it's a component but not the whole thing, not something that embraces the whole thing. Yeah, Danny.
And as I'm looking at it, particularly if you look at the last half of the commandment and how it is summed up, the emphasis is not on us. The emphasis is on God's action. So I'm wondering if the answer to your question has to do more with God has labored these 6 days. And there's obviously made a distinction between this day and the sixth. He has labored here, but he's rested here. So the question, I think, becomes, what does rest mean as far as God goes? So we obviously know that that doesn't mean taking a nap. So my best guess is...
At least not completely. At least not completely.
Not in the sense that he needs a pillow and a comfy blanket.
Yeah.
So what does that mean for him to rest? Well, as you think back to what is said about the commandments, to creation, he looked at it and it was good. So as you think back, what's the only component that is missing in all this? And in my mind, it is God's interaction and his enjoyment in that which he has created and made good. So it is his participation with his creation, enjoying what he has done. And then as you go back to the first part of that commandment, it is our participation in that. I guess I'll leave it there.
Okay. Yeah.
I was just going to say really fast, but I agree absolutely with that. But does it also contain an element of us reflecting God by taking dominion? And because we're providing rest for our, the command is female servant.
If only we had more time, because you guys are heading right for the bullseye. Okay, so what I want us to think. I'll just say one more thing, and then we'll chew on this, and y'all can chew on it for the week, and then formulate your so that when I asked this at the beginning, so what did y'all come up with? Now don't forget to think about this week. Okay, I want to hear some people say, well, here's what I think it is. I've worked this out. Here's the thing about something that Danny, you brought this up, and actually, Gail, you did too, and you are now. What most people don't think of when they read the fourth commandment is the fact that there's more than one part to the command. It's not just remember the seventh day or the Sabbath day or the first day, which is the Lord's day. It's 6 days shalt thou labor. That's a command. That's part of the command. 6 days shall you labor. So it's not just a command to rest, observe the Sabbath. It's a command also to work on the first 6 days. Now, this is what Calvin didn't, there's no grammatical basis for this. But Calvin said, and they're all call imperfects in the Hebrew. So there are three verbs there, and they're all parallel. And to set apart the seventh day, he said that was a command, but the other two are statements of fact. You labor 6 days and do all your work. Well, no. If any of them are statements of fact, given the grammar of it, it's almost certain they're all statements of fact. If one of them is a command, all of them are a command. We take them that way. But here's the significance of that. Calvin said that the 6 days of labor, that resting is resting from sin, resting from our sinful works. And so the work of 6 days, to Calvin, he was saying that's representative of sinful works. And so the thing is, he only saw the command of the Sabbath day in reference to or in the context of the fall, not in the context of creation. But it was instituted before the fall in the context of creation. So it has to do with something. And so he was totally conceiving of it in terms of, okay, you got these sinful works. That's what the 6 days of labor represent. But you're to rest from that. And the ultimate significance of that is you rest from sin in order that God can do his sanctifying work. And that was his whole understanding of the Sabbath, which had a lot of different implications for Calvin. He didn't see, because the responsibility to rest from our sinful work and to worship and these types of things, that's something we have a perpetual and constant responsibility to do. And so honoring one day above the others is abrogated in the New Covenant. And so worship for Calvin was appropriate every day. That's why he preached 7 days a week in Geneva, not just on the Lord's Day. And he said that observation of the Lord's Day is not something that's required for Christians, but it's something that we do as a matter of expediency because of our sin, we tend to neglect this. And so we have this convention that we follow. We observe the Lord's Day. I don't think that's really it because I think he missed that it refers to creation, not just redemption. And that the redemption, just like all of redemption, all of salvation is a recreation. So fundamentally the way we think about it has to go back to creation. It's not just in light of sin that we think of the Sabbath. It's God's activity in creation. And what does that have to do with? Okay. This is how we begin to flesh it out, okay? So we'll continue this next week.